Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Peter Gizzi. He's a poet. He has a book from Wesleyan University Press. It's called Threshold Songs. It's his fifth full collection. And in the book, within poems, unanswerable questions occur. I think the first one I remembered seeing was, "What is the role of art?" Later on in the book, he asks if they still call it a world. Why the unanswerable questions that occur in this book?
First of all, thanks for having me on your show, Michael.
Thank you.
I think the unanswerable questions are the ones that is the job of poetry to try to give voice to an answer. It's the difficulty of life and the things that we experience every day that otherwise go either unrecognized, unhonored, or unsaid, and that the poem can somehow give voice to.
Why do you think that poetry has become so difficult, contemporary poetry, what they call experimental poetry?
Well, for me, I guess I kind of value all sorts of modalities of poetry. I don't kind of put it in those terms, but I think the world has become complicated, and I think that the field of writing and of poetry has exploded in such a way that there are now people who have become very, you know, educated in reading poetry, and so therefore so much poetry is being written to other poets. But that said, whether a poem is simple or complicated, the history of poetry is poets singing to one another. If we have anything as a poet, if I have anything in my life, it's others' poems. To me, the greatest experience and the greatest emotional gift, intellectual gift I've been given is the work of other poets.
Now, this book, I guess, is special because, as I understand it, in its dedication, it's to your mother who died, a best friend who died, and a brother who died recently. And so what did that do to your ability to write poetry?
It made it really hard. And the thing that I'm always interested in, but the pressure was even harder, was to somehow be honest and to not simplify the complicated emotions that I was processing and the complicated reality of watching someone go from the outer world to the inner world. The fact is, the dead do not go away. They're still very much with me. And I wanted to sing to them, and I wanted them to sing through me. And so hence the threshold. These two voices are happening simultaneously.
Yeah. Now you say, for Robert, for Mother, for Mike, called back.
Yes.
What does that mean to you?
Well, it's it's a reference to me because Emily Dickinson is someone that I revere and we should all revere. She's one of the great practitioners of our language. And the last words that she wrote in a letter to her cousins were, "Little cousins called back, love, Emily." And on her grave in Amherst, Massachusetts, because I teach at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, in the grave it says her birth date, and then her death date, and it says, doesn't say died, it says called back.
That's so beautiful.
So to me, if you think of the Orphic in poetry, the idea that Orpheus has to go into the underworld and rescue the beloved to try to bring them back, one of the great roles that poetry can do is bring things back that are otherwise gone to the culture, and that could be literature, lost kingdoms, lost joys, games, lost books, but also the lost beloved, is that poetry, I believe, can bring these things back into the world of light and speech and give them a voice and put them right in front of us, put them right in the room.
Now, when I looked at it and I saw called back, my brow furrowed, because for me, called back means it was defective. They called it back.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, I think this happens in your poems in an interesting way all the time, that there's a sublime meaning and then a dark meaning, like called back, you know.
Yeah.
We were all not made to function here. So they called us back where we could be repaired for a while before they'd put us here again.
I like that reading a lot. In fact, I appreciate that. I do believe that the reader makes the meaning of the poem. It's an engagement between the reader and the writer. It's this incredible contract. And the reading that you've just given it, it's there. But I also think that without knowing the Dickinson, just the idea of if someone's called back, if you know the Bible, it's Lazarus. It has many meanings.
Now, you mentioned that there's a poem that you'd like to read. I first have to ask you what its title means. It's called Analemma.
That's great. It's a word that I discovered while writing this book. During the composition of this book, I was responsible for taking care of my mother, someone whose two great gifts were food and criticism. And she was great at both. And it was a great honor to be able to do that, to be able to give back. In fact, Dickinson has this other quote, "I never had a mother until she became my child." And so when I had this opportunity to be there for this woman who was so fierce, who knew that would be one of the most amazing years of my life, until she taught me how to go. That said, while I was taking care of her, I was actually reading a National Geographic while she was having chemo, and I saw this word analemma. I was like, I've kind of heard of that. And finally, it's just a simple term that's with us all the time. It's a scientific term. And the analemma is the path that the sun makes over our heads in a given year. And so it creates the figure eight. If you were to photograph the sun every day at, let's say, 1 p.m. out your door, in a year, it would create this figure eight above our heads. And this is where we get our sign for infinity. It's where we get the number eight. And so that, in fact, is the analemma. And of course, being a writer, I like words that are in other words. When I hear analemma, I think of dilemma. I think of this is what I get. I mean, this is what I hear. It's private, but this is what I hear. Analemma. That I came back to live in the region both my parents died into, that I will die into. If I have nothing else, I have this, and it's not morbid to think this way, to see things in time, to understand I'll be gone, that the future is already somewhere. I'm in that somewhere, and what of it? It's okay to see these things, to be the way they are. I can be them, have been them, will be there soon. I know why I came here, to be back here where my parents went. I know that I'll be there to join them soon. It's okay to think this way. Why shouldn't I? Who's gonna say I shouldn't? A doctor? Some friend? I have no wife in this. At night, late, the dark, myself at the ceiling, the arguments continue. I'm with it. It's with me. I am Kelka Shows, something with birds in it. A storm high above Albany. I am Ghost Brain. I, sister to all things cruelty, the mouse back gray of every afternoon, and you're sorrowing now that you're gone and I'm here, or now that you're here and I'm gone, or now that you're gone and I'm gone. What did we learn? What did we take from that? Oh, always dilating now that you're here and also gone. I am just learning that threshold and changing light, a leafy shape blue drifting above an upstate New York Mohican light, a tungsten light, boxcar lights, an oaken table wrapping archival light, burnt over, shaking.
That's Peter Gizzi reading the poem Analemma from his book Threshold Songs. Now, when I saw it, I thought, a bride gets carried over a threshold, and there's a threshold between life and death, and then again there's the pain threshold, that point beyond which you can't stand it anymore. And the poems seem to address all three in their way. But thresholds seem to have a place in anthropology now as being the borderline between the sacred and the profane, the movement between worlds.
Yes, exactly. It's really interesting that you mention the sacred and the profane, because in another poem in this book, Pinocchio's Gnosis, I use the term, I say, "Hey there, Mr. Sacer inter presque deorum. How about a good bray, a laugh track, and sync with your lyre?" It's a bit of a wiggy line, yeah? But the "Hey you, Mr. Sacer inter presque deorum," that is the epithet that Ovid gives. It's the epithet. Or what's a simpler way to say that? It's the other name or the characterizing phrase that Ovid, the first century Roman poet, gives to Orpheus in his book The Metamorphosis. And so it means the sacred interpreter of God in man. And so what Ovid is telling us about the role of poetry, that the sacred resides neither with man nor with God, it's in the interpretation. And that is the role of the poet. And Orpheus, of course, in Western culture is the ultimate figure of the poet. And so it's really interesting, and that's a kind of threshold, and I'm interested in this movement. I'm interested in betweenness, and I believe in the voice of poetry that it's me speaking, but it's also the dead speaking. And it's not just my mother, my brother, or Robert, or my father, or the other people, that Robert Creeley, the teachers that I've known in my life. It's also the vast continuum of poetry. I'm calling it and them back as well, or at least that's my wild, mad occupation or dream.
Now, tell me, because this is something I want to believe. Do poets know things that other people don't know?
Oh, definitely.
Thank you.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I just think that the great gift that poetry, if it's given me anything in my life, it's given me the ability to listen. And I had to learn how to listen. And this is the thing that poetry has given. That's its education. And then the hope is, of course, that in learning how to listen, that I can one day, hopefully, listen to learn about the world. And it's a simple, you know, turn of phrase I just made, but it's an enormous occupation that's limitless.
You know, a lot of the poets I've had on tell me that that's what they do. They listen.
Huh. That's great.
It's a wonderful thing, of course. Now, there have been poets, certainly in our time, Pound, and I know that your first book, Periplum, is a word that Pound himself invented.
Exactly.
Who really wanted to create a syllabus that would allow you to read his poems, and then you would know what he found valuable, eternal, true in the world. Many people now look at the Cantos, which was the name of his book, his great book, and they say, I don't know how to go about doing this. In other words, the instruction manual isn't there. How do you attain it?
Through hours and long study. It requires a long head, you know. It's not surface information. It's something that I have to then really take time with, the way an architect learns their trade or the way a mathematician learns their trade. But I was grateful for the education and the poets that Ezra Pound taught me when I was a teenager. Why him and why I found him, God knows. But for whatever reason, he captivated my imagination and he gave me a syllabus, as you say, a reading list, which included Ovid and Homer and Confucius and Dante and 12th century French troubadour poets of romance, and then also, you know, ancient Chinese poets. And it just went on and it went on. And not only was it that, then he was completely up to speed, you know, by turning me on to people like Eliot, William Carlos Williams, Louis Sukofsky, George Oppen, Basil Bunting. It's just staggering when you look at the syllabus, as you say, of this man's imagination, how he put it together. Sometimes I like it better than others, but I'm grateful for the reading list. Not all poets, you know, are egg-headed elegists, but so many of them I have a great love for. I love this part of poetry.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Peter Gizzi, the author, most recently, of Threshold Songs. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Peter Gizzi about his new book of poems, Threshold Songs, haunting poems as much for the meaning that he finds to put in them as for the sound and the music of them. Now, in the time that I've been reading poetry, the poetry that you didn't understand because there was something you didn't yet know, like the poetry of Ezra Pound, has given way to another kind of poetry, equally fascinating to me, a poetry that is not made for research, but is made for almost, what would you say, instinctual knowledge.
Somatic, yeah.
That you live with, and as you get to know the poem, if you read it again and again and again, you will in some way know it, even if you're never certain. What about those kinds of poets?
Those are the best kind. Those are the ones, you know, I think it's true for Pound too. I didn't know what some of the words were when I read them, but there was a sonic quality, a kind of cant to the voice or an intensity of expression and a movement. And there were moments that were very clear and captivating, so that I could let the more, you know, the pieces I didn't know go, and I could get that other meaning. But it's true for all the poets that I love, like Dickinson or Whitman. It's true when I first read Melville. It's true for all writing. There's a kind of like, I definitely get some instinctual piece, and then as I read further, it's like fathomless. I can keep falling and falling and going deeper and deeper into it. And one of the things that's great about poetry for me, first of all, is how sensuous it is, that it's a quality of music, of song. And that has a long history for me.
One of the things that fascinates me about Emily Dickinson and that people forget, you know, at first I thought, how did she manage to be so strange, so deep, and to use language in such an unprecedented way? And then I remembered she read the Bible.
Exactly.
That's to say that the Bible, which we only quote a tiny percentage of and only know a smaller percentage still of, is full of strangeness and mysteriousness. And it's almost as if you have to look at every word and ask what it means to you. It's a visionary work, and the visions are not always plain. And I think that Emily Dickinson learned to live with the august strangeness of recognition that you don't understand.
Exactly. But I think that poetry, and says her poetry behaves in the same manner then in the idea of what it is to encounter and read the Bible. But I'm not sure who the we are anymore. I don't know how to speak to the we, and I won't go into it now, who knows or doesn't know the Bible. You know, religions or politics in this country. So I'm going to stay away from that.
I don't know the Bible. When I just read Harold Bloom's newest book, he quoted sections that I could swear I never saw there before. And it's because he has an eye and an ear, right. And the things that he...
Good. Okay. I see. Yeah. I see what you mean. Because I was... The Bible has a scary reality in the world, sadly. I prefer the Dickinsonian method of reading the Bible. Or I prefer the Whitman way of reading. See, Dickinson and Whitman to me, what I think of Dickinson as the father of American poetry, and I think of Whitman as the mother of American poetry. Each one of them encountered the Bible and Psalms, and they found a way to exfoliate it and bring it in and create something like our language. For Whitman, he sexualizes it. He takes the form of the Bible and he puts it on the street. He makes it bark and he gives it a body. And then for Dickinson, it's, you know, she's more admonitory, meaning she's more critical. She has the language of the father.
You mentioned that you could talk about the music of poetry, and that's what I want to hear about now.
When I was a boy, I was the youngest by many years. My next brother was 9 years older than me, and the next one was 11. And music was a big part of the family. And, of course, growing up Catholic, we used to go to church. And so the liturgy was very beautiful to me. It was in a language. It was in Latin. I had really no idea, but I completely sensed the enormous claims that were being made in a language I otherwise did not understand, which was being sung. It also, singing in church with my family was a social thing. I enjoyed that. I felt that I was part of them because as a child I always couldn't articulate myself. I had a stammer. But when I sang, I didn't have the stammer. And I could participate and be with these people that, you know, otherwise didn't always understand or I couldn't always make myself clear to them. And then growing up with my older brothers through the 60s, and that was their generation, listening to Bob Dylan, for instance, when I was 5, I knew that these enormous claims were being made even if I couldn't understand the entire context. I was moved by the attack, by the cadence, by the forcefulness, by the intensity and the honesty of what I was hearing. But also I could read in the faces of the people in the room as a boy the seriousness at which they were receiving this information. And I knew that song, therefore, had this central position in my life because it articulated something in the room that I, as a boy, otherwise could not say.
It was interesting to me. When I was growing up, similarly, when I would go to the synagogue, I loved the prayers, but I never thought until a couple of years ago to ask where the music came from until I went to other synagogues in other parts of the country where the songs sounded different. I thought, wait, you know, I want to sing it the way we sang it in the shul back home. And that sense of music that comes in childhood, it seems to me, is the music that is behind poetry.
I think that's a nice way to think about it. I can't disagree. In fact, I think that's my experience. And that's another kind of called back, right? I'm calling back the sounds when I was young that, you know, gave me this kind of this wonder, the sense of imagination. Even in the poem Analemma that I read, you can hear liturgy in the way in which it turns in that kind of sense of movement now that we're talking about it.
It seems to me that the poems in the second section of the book are the most musical ones. Could you read one of those?
Gray Sail. If I were a boat, I would probably roll over. If I were a prayer, if I were a beach stave, beach bark, if I were a book, I would sing in streets, alone in traffic. If I had a gown, I could be heroic with a flowering mane. If I had a boat, I would eat a sandwich in broad, dazed light. I would come visit as a holy book if I were a boat, if I had a prayer.
Gray Sail by my guest, Peter Gizzi. Now, let's talk about some of the phrasings here. When I saw broad dazed light, of course in the back of our minds we hear broad daylight.
That's the hope.
Yeah. And a lot of the phrases in your poems have underphrasings, things that you hear in the background that you're meant to hear, that are, in a way, if you looked at a manuscript paper, you'd see the painting of the white Caraceable in the old days when there was a typewriter.
Exactly.
And you
That's
could
how
see
I came up.
The rewritten version that sounds almost the same. How does that work?
Well, for me, it kind of gives a kind of depth to language. It does two things. It kind of gives it a body, because when you hear that undersong to it, or what was the word you used, an underword or an undersound, I like that. It gives this kind of dimension or depth to it, because then you're hearing two things at once, and it's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of phase shifting. And then it also makes you aware of language, but it also makes you aware that we often hear or mishear, and, you know, mishearing is a form of knowing as well. It's a form of understanding. So I'm interested in those kind of slippages. And even if I'm writing and I'm rewriting something or editing something, sometimes that'll happen, and like I'll misread the poem I've just written to myself, and I realize, oh wait, that's better.
So it's as if we not only can understand a poem, but we have permission to misunderstand it as well.
Oh please, yes, yeah, I hope so, because I think misunderstanding is a big part of understanding. I have no claim to understand anything unless I kind of, you know, have to think about it a few ways and not understand it in order for me to come to some kind of, you know, purposeful meaning.
I've been talking with Peter Gizzi. That's a beautiful place to end, with purposeful meaning as a result of misunderstanding. He's the author, most recently, of Threshold Songs, published by Wesleyan University Press. Thank you, Peter, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
It's been a real pleasure. You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. My assistant is Craig Erthine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mail of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.